The Principles of Economics, Lecture 6. International Trade and Protectionism. Where did our jobs go?
Hi, I'm Peter Navarro, and welcome to Lecture 6, the first of two lectures on international trade. The two very big questions we're going to start with in this lecture are, why do nations trade, and how do nations decide what to import and export? To answer these questions, we are going to explore two very interesting concepts, the principle of absolute advantage versus that of the principle of comparative advantage. The idea of absolute advantage as a basis for trade was first set forth by Adam Smith in the 1700s. Adam Smith said that a country that can produce a good at a lower cost than another country will have an absolute advantage in the production of that good. For example, Saudi Arabia has millions of barrels of cheaply accessible oil, but growing food in its desert climate and sandy soil is very expensive. In contrast, the United States can grow food cheaply in its temperate climate and fertile soil, but American oil isn't as cheap to extract as Saudi crude. Because it can produce a certain amount of oil with fewer resources, Saudi Arabia thus has an absolute advantage over the United States in producing oil, just as the United States has an absolute advantage over Saudi Arabia in producing food. At least in this case, the theory of absolute advantage would predict, and in this case quite correctly, that America should sell food to Saudi Arabia and buy oil from it. At first glance, the principle of absolute advantage appears to make eminent sense. Nonetheless, it has a significant implication and one that is badly flawed. To see why, consider this example. One country, let's say Germany, is able to produce both food and autos more cheaply than another country, say Algeria. In such a case, the theory of absolute advantage would predict that Germany has nothing to gain from trading with Algeria. After all, why should Germany trade with a country that cannot produce anything as efficiently as it can? Why indeed? Because this is where a more subtle understanding of trade patterns enters the picture. And this more subtle understanding is embodied in the theory of comparative advantage. The theory of comparative advantage was first set forth in 1817 by the English economist David Ricardo. The historical context for the development of Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage is interesting in and of itself. At the time, Europe was considering protecting its markets from American imports through the use of tariffs or quotas. Europe's concern was that America, with its abundant land and inexpensive labor, would have an absolute advantage in producing many goods and might therefore not import anything from Europe, but merely export its cheaper goods, thereby destroying jobs in Europe. Ricardo addressed these concerns by articulating the principle of comparative advantage. This principle holds that each country will benefit if it specializes in the production and export of those goods that it can produce at a relatively lower cost than other countries. Conversely, each country will benefit if it imports those goods that it produces at a relatively higher cost. And note today that it is this simple principle of comparative advantage, although one more subtle than the principle of absolute advantage, that provides the unshakable basis for international trade. To demonstrate the theory of comparative advantage, let's go back in our time machine to Ricardo's day and imagine a debate between Ricardo and another economist in front of a group of European trade ministers trying to decide whether to impose protective tariffs on America. The other economist I'm going to call John Strawman. Lord Strawman is a strong supporter of the theory of absolute advantage and therefore wishes to erect protectionist trade barriers against the Americans. To make his argument, Strawman presents a table that I have reproduced in Chapter 6 of your study guide. It shows how much labor is necessary to produce food and clothing in America versus Europe. From that table, you will see that America has a clear absolute advantage in the production of both food and clothing. This is because in America, it takes 1 hour of labor to produce 1 unit of food, while a unit of clothing requires 2 hours of labor. In contrast, in Europe, the cost of 1 unit of food is 3 hours of labor, while 1 unit of clothing costs 4 hours of labor. In other words, it's cheaper to produce both food and clothing in America than in Europe, at least in absolute terms. And John Strawman uses this data to call for tariffs on high American imports to effectively block their sale. But looking at this table, the skeptical David Ricardo asked John Strawman the same question I will ask you now. Which country has the comparative advantage in food versus clothing? Again, if you look carefully at the table in your lecture guide, you will see that America has the comparative advantage in food, but Europe has the comparative advantage in clothing. This is because clothing is relatively more expensive in America, while food is relatively more expensive in Europe. And what I mean by that is this. In America, a unit of food costs one-half that of a unit of clothing. However, in Europe, a unit of food costs three-quarters that of a unit of clothing. Now, here's what is really important about this observation. You should immediately see at this point that if the Europeans could trade some of their clothing for some of America's food, both countries would be better off. But John Strawman doesn't yet understand this, so David Ricardo has to use a simple example based on Strawman's table in your study guide to explain this. Ricardo says to Strawman, suppose that both America and Europe have 600 hours of labor available. That would mean that America could produce 300 units of clothing or 600 units of food or some combination thereof. In contrast, using 600 hours of labor, Europe can produce 150 units of clothing or 200 units of food or again, some combination thereof. Now, given these facts, Ricardo asks Strawman this question. If Europe cuts off trade with America, what's the most it could consume? Strawman's answer, of course, is no more than 150 units of clothing or 200 units of food or some combination thereof. At which point, Ricardo turns to John Strawman and says, but suppose that I sent you to America with 150 units of clothing. How many units of food could you trade that for? Well, Strawman says, I know that clothing costs twice as much as food in terms of labor requirements in America, so I might be able to trade Europe's clothing for as much as 300 units of food. At this point, Ricardo shouts, aha! That's 100 more units than Europe could have produced with its own labor resources alone. That is, in the absence of trade with America. And at this point, Strawman's eyes finally light up as he understands what economists call the gains from trade that can result from countries specializing in the production of goods for which they have a comparative advantage relative to their trading partners. And because of these possible gains from trade, Strawman drops his bid to impose protectionism on the U.S. and joins Ricardo as a free trader. The broader point of this story, of course, is that the theory of comparative advantage is one of the deepest truths in all of economics, and nations that disregard the lessons of comparative advantage and try and hide behind protectionist trade barriers will pay a heavy price in terms of their living standards and economic growth. Well, so far, I've mentioned things like tariffs and protectionist trade barriers, but I haven't really explained just exactly what they are and how they arise. That's the next issue I'd like to turn to now. To better understand the politics of protectionism, let us again return in our time machine to another meeting between David Ricardo, Lord John Strawman, and the European trade ministers. It is now 2 years after these trade ministers voiced their support for free trade, and since that time, there has been a flood of American food imports into Europe. while the European clothing industry has grown dramatically and is experiencing record profits because of heavy exports to America, thousands of European farmers have been put out of work by cheaper American grain, beef, and dairy products. This unemployment has provoked political unrest, and newspapers from farm districts around Europe have fanned the flames of discontent. They have written scathing editorials calling for voters to throw out the political rascals and replace them with leaders who will protect the European economy by supporting strict quotas on American food imports. Do you see the political problems that free trade can create? Can you see that the farmers harmed by free trade are likely to be far more vocal politically than the clothing manufacturers and workers helped by free trade? In fact, this is an age-old problem faced by political leaders who support free trade. Even though free trade can provide benefits to all countries and create thousands of jobs in export industries, it can just as easily destroy jobs domestically in import-competing industries. Given the enormous political pressures that can build for protectionism, it is useful then for us to analyze the two most common ways of restricting trade: tariffs and quotas. A tariff is simply a tax on imports that is collected by the government. The question, of course, is who wins and who loses in the economic arena when a tariff is imposed? Well, clearly, domestic producers win because they don't have to cut their prices so much to compete with foreign imports. And, of course, the government wins with a tariff because it is able to collect large tariff revenues. However, the biggest loser is the consumer. Not only does the price of the good with a tariff rise, consumers will pay more while actually consuming less of the good. Finally, the broader economy loses. This is because resources in the domestic economy, which might otherwise be used to produce other valuable goods or services, are diverted to the protected industries. Together with the reduction in consumer welfare, this creates an efficiency loss that economists often refer to as a deadweight loss. And of course, some of the gains from trade are lost as well. From a political perspective, what is perhaps most interesting about this example is that a relatively small handful of people in one domestic industry have benefited from the tariff, and in doing so have gained a considerable profit at the expense of a much larger but politically less powerful group, namely consumers. Now, let's ask ourselves the question, do we get the same result with a protectionist quota? And by the way, a quota is simply an explicit quantity limit on imports. Well, the only real difference between a tariff and a quota is that with a quota, there are no revenues paid to the government. Instead, the foreign producers are able to enjoy at least some additional profits from the higher prices that result from a quota, even if they are forced to sell less of their product. What is interesting about this result is that from a political standpoint, it's a bit easier for a country to impose quotas than tariffs on another country because there is less harm to the foreign producers and therefore less political pressure on a foreign government to retaliate with tariffs or quotas of their own. In fact, retaliation is one of the biggest dangers that a country which imposes protectionist measures faces, as retaliatory tariffs and quotas can trigger a trade war. That's exactly what happened during the Great Depression when America imposed the infamous Smoot-Hawley tariffs, Europe retaliated, and the global economy fell into a cavern as massive gains from trade were lost. Despite numerous lessons such as this of the dangers of protectionism, tariffs, quotas, and other so-called non-tariff barriers, this kind of protectionism is alive and well today. To understand why, it's useful to look at some of the major arguments in favor of protectionism. For starters, there is the national defense or military self-sufficiency argument. This is not an economic argument, but rather a political and strategic one. In particular, protective tariffs are needed to preserve or strengthen industries such as steel or motor vehicles that produce goods and materials essential for the defense of the country or for war. Unfortunately, there is no objective criterion for weighing the worth of an increase in national security relative to a decrease in economic efficiency accompanying the reallocation of resources towards strategic industries. And although we might all agree that it is not a good idea to import our missile guidance systems from China, if you're in the United States, the self-sufficiency argument is nevertheless open to serious abuse, since nearly every industry can directly or indirectly claim a contribution to national security. One problem with this argument has to do with an important economic concept called the fallacy of composition. In particular, all nations cannot simultaneously succeed in import restrictions so that what might be true for one nation cannot be true for all nations. What I mean is that the exports of one nation must necessarily be the imports of another. To the extent that one country is able to stimulate its economy through an excess of exports over imports, another economy's unemployment problem may be worsened by the resulting excess of imports over exports. It is no wonder, then, that the use of tariffs and quotas to achieve domestic full employment are termed beggar thy neighbor policies. They may achieve short-run domestic goals, but they do so only by making trading partners poorer. Now, closely related to the jobs argument and the beggar thy neighbor problem is the dumping argument. Dumping occurs when foreign producers sell their exports at a price less than the cost of production. Why might they do this? One possible reason is to drive competitors out of a market, seize that market, and then use their newfound monopoly power to later raise prices. In such a case, the long-term economic profits resulting from this dumping strategy may more than offset the earlier losses which accompany the dumping. Because dumping is a legitimate concern, it is prohibited under international trade law. But I hasten to add here that dumping still goes on. Still a fourth and slightly more complicated argument for protectionism is called the terms of trade or optimal tariff argument. The idea here is to impose a tariff that will shift the terms of trade in a country's favor and against foreign countries. Here's how this optimal tariff would work. A large country, such as the United States, might impose a tariff on foreign oil. This reduces United States demand for oil imports and thereby exerts downward pressure on the world price of oil. This in turn improves the United States' terms of trade. Finally, a truly favorite argument in support of protectionism in developing countries is the so-called infant industry argument. The idea here is that temporarily shielding young domestic firms from the severe competition of more mature and more efficient foreign firms will give infant industries a chance to develop and become efficient producers. This argument must be weighed cautiously. Historical studies have turned up some genuine cases of protected infant industries that grew up to stand on their own two feet. But the history of tariffs reveals even more contrary cases in which perpetually protected infants have not shed their diapers after lo these many years. I should note at this point that while we have focused primarily on tariffs, many nations also use so-called non-tariff barriers or NTBs. NTBs, which include quotas, also consist of formal restrictions or regulations that make it difficult for countries to sell their goods in foreign markets. For example, a country such as Japan might restrict the import of all vegetables grown where certain pesticides are used, knowing full well that all other countries besides Japan use these pesticides. The effect of such a regulation would be to halt the import of any vegetables. In a similar way, a country like France in the past has used a maze of regulations to clog its ports to discourage other countries from exporting to France. As a final comment on trade and protectionism, one of the good things to emerge from the retaliatory trade wars of the 1930s has been the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, or the so-called GATT Treaty. The GATT was established at the end of World War II, and at the beginning of 1995, it became the World Trade Organization, or WTO. Every few years, representatives of the major industrial countries meet together for a round of trade talks aimed at reducing both tariffs and non-tariff barriers. At least thus far, with every round of the GATT, trade barriers have fallen further around the globe. Still, all is not rosy with the international trading world, not by a long shot. Many countries, like the United States, continue to run huge trade deficits, while economies of emerging countries like China and India are booming, but seemingly so only at the expense of taking hundreds of thousands of jobs away from places like the U.S., Europe, and even Mexico. To get a better handle on these trade deficits, let's move to the next topic in this lecture, some trade deficit accounting. And with apologies to Snow White, let me begin this topic by asking this question. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the biggest debtor nation of them all? The surprising answer is not Brazil or Mexico or some other developing country. Rather, it is the richest nation in the world, the United States of America. In this regard, the U.S. has come full circle. For when America was in its infancy, it was likewise a debtor nation. In fact, from the beginning of the Revolutionary War until well after the Civil War, America borrowed heavily from the nations of Europe to build its capital stock and infrastructure. It wasn't until the U.S. helped Europe fight two world wars that the debtor's shoe was put on the other foot. During those years, the U.S. greatly expanded its exports to Europe, and after each war, it lent large sums of money to the combatants for post-war relief. In the course of doing so, the U.S. became the world's largest creditor nation. All that has changed now. Beginning in the early 1980s, America began running huge trade deficits, and over the years, these trade deficits have led to an accumulated net foreign debt running into the trillions of dollars. To many observers, America's chronic trade deficits are every bit as dangerous as its chronic budget deficits. These trade deficit hawks warn that America is being forced to sell off its land and its factories and its future to finance these deficits. Others, however, see the trade deficit simply as an opportunity to buy inexpensive foreign goods and enjoy a higher standard of living than Americans could otherwise achieve. These trade deficit doves argue that, hey, if foreign countries are foolish enough to sell us cheap goods, we should be wise enough to buy and enjoy them and not try to erect protectionist trade barriers. To see who is right in this whole debate, the hawks or the doves, we now need to better understand some of the intricacies of so-called balance of payments accounting. To set the stage for a discussion of this topic, let's first examine the explosive growth of the U.S. trade deficit as the U.S. has, over time, become more and more of what's called an open economy. An open economy is simply one that engages in international trade, and a useful measure of such openness is something economists call the trade share. This trade share is simply the ratio of a country's exports or imports to its gross domestic product. 50 years ago, this trade share for the United States was minuscule, as America was largely self-sufficient. However, since 1965, as the American economy has opened and the economies of its trading partners have grown, imports and exports have more than doubled as a percentage of the gross domestic product. Beginning in the 1980s, the U.S. began importing a lot more than it has exported, and this has led to what, after the turn of this century, has turned out to be an explosive rate of growth in America's foreign debt. Now let's get to this issue of balance of payments accounting. Let's start by identifying an important accounting relationship between what is called the current account versus what's called the capital account. Put simply, if a country such as the U.S. runs a trade deficit in its current account, It must balance that deficit with inflows into its capital account. This is called the basic trade identity equation. It is illustrated in your course guide in Chapter 6 with a table showing the U.S. balance of payments schedule for a typical year. If you were to turn to your course guide now, you would see the current account consists of three major items: the merchandise trade balance, fees for services, and net investment income. The merchandise trade balance is by far the biggest item. It reflects trade in commodities such as food and fuels and manufactured goods. And in that table in your course guide, the U.S. shows accounting debits or imports of $803 billion and credit or exports of $612 billion. Subtracting one from the other, we then have a net merchandise trade deficit of minus $191 billion. And when you read in the newspaper that the United States is running a trade deficit, it is this merchandise trade balance to which journalists often are referring. But this is only part of the total picture. In fact, the second item in the current account is fees for services. Such services include shipping, financial services, and foreign travel. While this fees category is much smaller than the merchandise trade balance, it has been growing in recent years as the U.S. has shifted from a manufacturing economy to a more service-oriented economy. This growth has helped offset at least some of the large merchandise trade deficits. Still, a third item in the current account is investment income. For example, the table in your course guide shows a credit of $206 billion. This represents the amount of income earned by Americans holding foreign assets, while the debit of $203 billion represents the amount of income earned by foreigners holding U.S. assets. Historically, this category has run a small surplus for the U.S. However, as foreigners have continued to accumulate more and more U.S. assets, this category is starting to run in the red, further exacerbating the trade deficit. Finally, there is a fourth item in the current account I need to tell you about. It's called unilateral transfers. It's just a catch-all category that represents other kinds of payments that are not in return for goods and services. Now, if you were to sum up all four items in the table in your course guide, we would wind up with the balance on the current account showing a deficit of $148 billion. And here's the important point. Because of the requirements of the trade identity equation, this deficit in the current account must be offset by a net surplus in the capital account. One part of the capital account shows something called official reserve changes. But of far greater consequence are the capital outflows and inflows, which track the purchases of both real assets like hotels and factories and golf courses, as well as financial assets such as stocks and bonds. For example, foreign purchases of U.S. assets represent capital inflows and might include the purchase of government bonds by the Chinese government, the buying of American stock by a Dutch mutual fund, or the acquisition of a factory in Pennsylvania by Japanese investors. Similarly, when U.S. investors purchase assets abroad, like hotel chains or foreign stocks, this results in capital outflows and a debit, such as the $376 billion represented in the table in your course guide. And summing U.S. and foreign purchases of assets, we get a balance of $141 billion in the table. Of course, when we add official reserves to this sum, we come up with a plus $148 billion, and this is just enough to offset the current account deficit and make the sum of the current and capital accounts equal to zero, just as our basic trade identity equation requires. Now, the next thing we have to learn about to get our mind around the problem that trade deficits can create is that of exchange rates. And more importantly, how changes in the exchange rates of different currencies are supposed to prevent the kind of long-term and chronic trade deficits that America has been experiencing. That will be the topic we will start off with in Lecture 7, one of the most fascinating in this series, that will focus on the international monetary system and issues associated with chronic trade deficits. In the meantime, please do try to complete your exercises in the course guide. I'm Peter Navarro from the University of California, Irvine.
After listening to Lecture 6, a student posed this question to Professor Navarro. You said that the GATT trade treaty was a good thing, but every time the countries meet, there are large-scale demonstrations. Why? Let's listen to the professor's response.
That's a great question. The GATT treaties are very controversial because trade around the world does create all sorts of kind of dislocations among people. Some of the problems that are raised in these protests, which are quite legitimate, are the poor wages that people are paid. There's also child labor issues where children are forced to work. And, of course, there's large environmental issues where in some countries they don't respect the environment and they use the abuse of the environment to get lower costs. So the gains from trade and all the prosperity we get do come sometimes at large human cost and environmental cost, and the protesters that come to these meetings are trying basically to bring attention to these problems so that they'll be discussed hopefully more within the context of the trade treaties themselves.
Another student then asked, how do the workers of a country like the U.S. with high wages and strong environmental protection regulations ever compete against developing nations like Mexico or China or Brazil that have large pools of workers willing to work for low wages and very little environmental protections?
There's two basic ways that America can try to protect itself while preserving the gains from trade and the prosperity of international trade. One way is to continue to be a technological innovator. It's okay for American workers to be paid a lot more than workers in China if they are a lot more productive. And to be more productive, that means they can be better educated and have more sophisticated machinery to work with. So the more we innovate here in America, the more we can keep pace and earn higher wages because we are more productive. The other important thing is that any time that the U.S. signs trade agreements, whether it's NAFTA with Mexico or whether it's a GATT treaty that involves other countries around the world, it's really important for this country to insist that environmental protection standards be part of any economic trade treaty. Otherwise, it'd be very difficult for the U.S. to compete.
Finally, one student wondered, what about countries like China and the Philippines that copy new technologies and software without paying the appropriate royalties?
In fact, this kind of copyright theft is very, very difficult to deal with. The only hope that we can have, say, in the United States or in Europe in fighting this kind of copyright piracy is what it is that as economies in China and the Philippines mature, then they begin to have as much stake in the global economy as all the other economies, and they begin to abide more by the laws. Barring that, there should really be strict payback and some kind of penalties for any kind of these copyright infringements, but sometimes that's difficult to do with some of these developing countries. But it's a very, very difficult issue.
This ends Lecture 6. If you borrowed this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399 and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.